Hey guys, thanks for joining us for this 8th episode in Season 4 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. Special guest on this episode is actor and singer Robert Davi. He's got an upcoming show, Robert Davi, My Kind of Town, at the Boca Black Box December 3rd. We're going to talk about his musical roots, to what finally motivated him to get in the recording studio after so many years in the acting industry. We're also going to discuss how much weight the average American expects to gain during the holidays. We'll also introduce you to the new Christmas list PowerPoint presentations. And think about this, how would you fare in an apocalypse? Now, if you would, please take the time to subscribe, comment, leave some feedback, and share with your friends. Now, you know you can indulge all you want over the holidays, but Shakespeare would say that there's a price to be paid, a pound of flesh. Well, many people are fine paying that cost 8 times over. According to a new survey, the average American expects to gain 8 pounds over the holidays this year. That's up from 5.5 pounds in the same survey last year. 72% of people say that they're planning to enjoy the end of the year without worrying about their diet. That's up from last year when only 54% said that. Now, 66% of people say that they'll postpone being healthy until 2024, which is also up from last year when 42% said they were kicking the can to 2023. But despite giving up on this year, 68% of people say that they're confident that they'll stick to healthy habits in 2024. But maybe not right away. Now, the average person says it takes about 19 days to get back on track after a period of letting themselves go. Now, you know kids can be sneaky and manipulative sometimes. Do you need proof? Well, Christmas list PowerPoint presentations are a thing now, and some of the ones that I've seen online, pretty sleek. Now, the idea is to present a list to your parents in the most organized way possible, and you'll up your chances of getting more stuff. Now, you also want to make the buying process easy by including links to everything. Now, it's not a brand new idea. A kid's PowerPoint wish list went viral last year too, but it's gaining steam because more people have smart TVs that pair with phones and computers, so kids can easily cast onto a big screen now. Now, some woman posted a 6-minute video of her daughter Kayla's presentation the other day. She ended up asking for $2,500 worth of stuff. Now, another strategy behind it is your parents will be impressed and proud of you, especially if they don't know how to do a PowerPoint. So they'll reward you with more gifts. Excited to talk to him once again. Got a show coming up next month, December 3rd, at Boca Black Box. It's got Robert Davi, and it's My Kind of Town. And Robert, it's a privilege to have the chance to visit with you. Looking forward to talk about the show as well.
And you too. It's great being able to see you in live here and have a good conversation about wherever we go.
That's right. Now tell us, I told you that I knew you had music in you from the first time I saw you on the screen in Goonies. So when did music first become such a big part of your life? Has it been your entire life, if you will?
Well, I guess you have to say that, being from an Italian American family and, you know, listening to the opera as a kid and loving classical music and, of course, the Great American Songbook, which was led by Sinatra and Dean Martin and Perry and the great crooners, Bing Crosby. But loving growing up in utero, probably, listening to that. So there was always an appreciation and a love for it, and also for acting. But it was around 8th grade where all of a sudden my voice changed. And then I had this, I remember in church, and they're looking at me as I'm, you know, just singing normally, but all of a sudden this voice happened. And then in high school, I went to Seton Hall High School. I was playing football. I was part of the forensic league. And I used to, like I said, listen to music and imitate opera and singing. And I was in the shower one day singing the song by Jay Black and the Americans, Remember, cara mio, why must we say goodbye? Because it had that operatic vibe in the beginning.
Right.
Each time on my heart. So I'm singing this in the shower. And, you know, the steam is going. A friend of mine comes in and he goes, Robert, Sister Gabriel Gerard wants to talk to you. I go, what? He was run by nuns. I go, no. She wants to know who's singing. Don't tell her it's me, because I already did. I says, I'm too busy. I'm on a football team. I was really a very, very good football player. Weeb Eubank from the Jets came to watch me play, and that was an option in my career. Wow. And I was winning awards all over the state and nation for acting. So I was pretty full tablet, you know,
right,
with trying to maintain a B, B minus average, C plus B minus average. And so I went to the door with, put a towel on, little crack in the door. I go, yes, sister. Is that you singing? Yes, sister. She goes, well, I want you to join the Glee Club. I says, sister, I've got a very busy plate and I'm not interested. Well, you know, Cameron, the name Glee Club was not something I wanted to do. It didn't seem cool at that time, right?
Right.
And she called my mother, Italian mom, and said, your son has a beautiful voice. I want him to try out for the Glee Club. And that was it. Mm-hmm. She said, try it. You may like it. And I did. And to be honest with you, I mean, I did love to sing and I loved music, but there was like three guys in the class and about 15 of these beautiful girls that were all in the class. And I said, I looked around and go, this is not a bad gig, actually. You know what I mean? Who knows? And so I started to sing, and they got me my first opera teacher, Michael Signorelli, and I won first place New York State solo competition in New York.
Wow.
And then, but I was acting at the same time, and then I let it go because my film career took off. And bingo. It wasn't until I directed a movie called The Dukes with me and Chaz Palminteri and Peter Bogdanovich. Yep. About a doo-wop group. And I sing one song in that, and this was 2008. And everyone's saying, why don't you sing? Why don't you sing? And I felt at the time that there was a lack, since Sinatra had passed. There was nothing providing that kind of edge on the stage and that kind of connection to the lyric,
right,
that he had, mm-hmm, the emotional response. And I felt I could do that. And I did a demo of four songs at Capitol Records, and they played it for Phil Ramone, who produced Tony Bennett, Sinatra, oh, all the Billy Joel. And Phil said, I want to produce your album. And went to number 6 Billboard Jazz. We put a show together, and I wanted a tribute, because I did my first film with Sinatra. Mm-hmm. I wanted a tribute what he did as a human being in terms of anti-Semitism and racial bigotry. Mm. People knew about his mafia connections and his love affair with women and all that other stuff. But I wanted to remind everyone his contribution to the great American songbook and to society. And that's where my motivation for wanting to do the shows was the first impulse.
And for you, your takeaway as well, the impact and the good things that you've done, as well as a result of your opportunities, what are maybe some of those that you take the most pride in that you've been able to maybe help out?
I never like to talk about that. You know, there was another thing, and I just had a recent conversation. Someone asked me about Sinatra. And there was a thing that, and I've helped out with a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. But Richard Burton did a thing at the Variety Club one year. And it was called Mr. Anonymous. And it was a listing of the things Sinatra had done and the favors and the things socially and for people and causes, always under the name of Mr. Anonymous. And for me to then list a bunch of things I did here, there, or the other, you know, the United Nations asked me to go around and sing for them. I did the thing for the Exceptional Children's Foundation, for many different organizations, mm-hmm, and for the Prince Albert, the oceans, the clean oceans, and a bunch of many, many different things. But I like to quietly do that stuff.
I understand that. I was more meaning not so much spouting about him, but talking about maybe because of seeing how Sinatra did it and also didn't get the acclaim, if maybe that affords you that opportunity or maybe motivates you is what I was meaning to say.
No, what motivates me, I think, was just the, you know, making a difference. You know, making a difference in whatever small way one can in this finite time we're on this earth. And that's basically the biggest motivation. And loving to, you know, connect to people. Loving to connect to people and to give back.
And who were maybe some of the people early in your career that were truly inspirational to you? Because I know we all, as we're trying to make a go of it in whatever venue we're trying to do, we have some struggles. We have some setbacks. Who were the ones that always had your back, maybe kept you motivated, even when you were having a hard time with it?
Well, I got to say, you know, my fourth grade teacher, Miss Alexander, who walked my parents out to the parking lot of the school of Half Hollow Hills, and she said, you have to encourage him in the arts. He's talented. So that was the first kind of, I guess, inspiration. And I was elated when she had said that. And then it continued on with the nuns and winning awards for acting and for singing. And then the teachers I had, and I studied with a woman named Stella Adler, who taught Marlon Brando and De Niro. She was the greatest acting teacher of all. I got a scholarship to Hofstra University for drama, their BFA program. So things along the way like that. And of course, Sinatra, when I did my first film with him, he was very encouraging and very helpful. Cubby Broccoli, when I did the Bond film, there were quite a few people, my first agents, there were quite a few people along the way that give you, they have some, give you some wind under your wings,
yeah,
to lift you. And when things get tough, you know, that's just life. You know, life is that friend of mine, George Englund. Now, George Englund was Brando's best friend. He wrote a book about Brando. He produced the thing I did in 1987, where I played a Palestinian of all people in this movie. Here I am, a Catholic guy, playing a Palestinian in a movie. It's actually topical today. But George had said, and he produced and directed The Ugly American with Marlon Brando. Mm-hmm. And he said one time, don't ever let the highs get you high, and don't ever let the lows get you low. And that's the golden rule, you know? And I translate that into, taste the bait, but don't swallow the hook. That's my little gem of telling someone.
No, I like that. Now, how do you, how hard was it the first time you got up and was doing Sinatra stuff in front of folks that knew Sinatra? I mean, was that a little scary for you the first time?
I guess the very first time, yeah, because it was the first time I had done a performance with a big orchestra, but I had my album went to number 6 on Billboard Jazz.
Yeah.
And as I said, Phil Ramone produced my album. And he produced a lot of Tony Bennett, all of Billy Joel. He produced Sinatra. He was a brilliant guy. And they had heard when I did my demo at Capitol Records, everyone was talking about, holy mackerel, who is this guy? And that's how Phil heard about it. And then he said, I want to produce your album. And then he helped me put my show together. And yeah, I was shaky the first shows I did with an orchestra. But then I think Quincy Jones came to one of my shows, brought 17 people, and then the next day put on his Facebook page, I don't know if you have the quote,
yeah,
but there's a full quote by Quincy Jones that he put on his thing and then from the public's reaction to what I was doing, you know?
Yeah, when you get up there and you start getting reaction, I know how that gets the juices flowing. How hard is it at the end of the night to stop the show?
It was, we just did a show in L.A., and it was a little difficult to stop. They wanted more, and I could have given them more, but, you know, they can't go overtime and pay everybody. You know, sometimes that's just, you know, look, an entertainer feels like that. And sometimes if there's a night like that, you want to go on. Sometimes you want to get the hell out of Dodge. But if things, if things are working, you want to give more, you know?
And for you, what's the biggest challenge about singing on stage for you? Is it the vulnerability of being up there a solo, if you will?
No, there's always a nerve-wracking aspect of it, and if you're going to be in voice,
yeah.
But if the voice is there, the ability to, and especially now at my period in life, having experienced a bunch of things for many decades and translating that my emotional life into something creative, and also being able to maybe connect with people, with the audience. There's a need, there's a certain need that they also feel. And it's me more about opening my heart to them and the receptive back and forth, whether it's elation or whether it's heartbreak or something politically motivated. That to me is the, so it's exposing your, it's connecting and exposing everyone's vulnerability together, because it's a unifying thing. And, like I said, when you're in great voice, it's working, and you just want your emotional life to be full and not, you know, you try to be there for every moment.
And is it cool to get the instant feedback from the live performance? I mean, I know that you've done that from stage as well. But how much do you have to train yourself for that instant feedback and not to react so much, if you will?
Well, sometimes you can lose it emotionally. I've had performances where I'm just so emotionally available to something. Something happened in the day or the night, or you see someone and you just imagine what they might be going through, and it grabs you. But there is no, it's not focusing on yourself. It's channeling the music. It's connecting to the audience, and as opposed to your own, even though you're in the spotlight, it's giving of oneself. You know, one time they said the actor was, or the singer was, a high priest of society, and it's almost like a very spiritual exchange, or should be. Especially with the American Songbook.
Yeah.
You know, Cameron, in 1957, the song that won the best Oscar was a song called All the Way, from a movie called The Joker is Wild. Now, cut to 2006. The song that won best Oscar was called It's Hard Out There for a Pimp. And you wonder why our society is dissipating. The American Songbook is the amalgam of the American experience, as is the country music is. You know what I mean? As a matter of fact, country is and the American Songbook are very similar in their storytelling and in the purity of their expression. And so you find yourself, wanting to have people understand that the great American Songbook is the Shakespeare of America.
That's right. Now the show coming up, My Kind of Town, coming up December 3rd. You got 3 and 7 o'clock. Tell our viewers, our listeners, a little bit about the show coming up.
Well, I'm going to be singing some standards, some of the chestnuts and stuff that isn't always covered, but are amazing emotional songs and a variety of things, stuff that you may expect Willie Nelson to sing, but I'll do it in my way. Or, the American Songbook of Sinatra, or Dean Martin, or Bing Crosby, because they all covered the great American Songbook. Sinatra didn't write the songs. He wrote really one song or so but mm-hmm. he covered them just like Tony Bennett did. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have a menu of tunes that tell a story. And again, it's not all the I like to do stuff that people aren't doing. My new album is coming out next year, and it's a variety of great standards, but stuff that no one's covered before, or maybe one person. And that to me is a challenge, to make an audience experience a new song they may not know, or that, of course, the ones that they do love, and to hear them in an exciting venue. Mm-hmm.
And how much do you pressure yourself whenever you cover those beloved favorites, those classics, if you will?
Pressure myself in what way, Cam?
I know as a professional how much you strive to always give your best, especially to the music, to the songwriter as well.
Yeah, you're trying to find it. You're trying to create an experience. Mm-hmm. You're not singing a song. You're creating an experience. Yeah. You're not crooning. That's the difference between a crooner and a singer. You're trying to create a theatrical moment within the song. And that's the challenge for me, to take it in a different direction while maintaining the absolute gloriousness of that music, but to personalize it in a way that now people get connected to it differently. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert, aside from the music, the acting is still some more new projects coming up on the horizon.
Yeah, I have a new TV series called Paper Empire that we're going to be finishing up, where I play a character named Lawrence Finch, who is a financial genius who helps create the Bitcoin, which leads to a financial Armageddon. He doesn't like the way the world is going, and he manipulates things, and it's very textured, very interesting. Denise Richards plays my wife. Kelsey Grammer plays an associate, Wesley Snipes. It's a terrific piece. Robert Gillings wrote and directed it. And then I have a film I just did in Tel Aviv, actually, just before the actor's strike. I was there. I did a movie called Bardejo, which is a town in Slovakia. It's 1942. It's a true story about the Holocaust. And I play, here I am, a Catholic guy, playing an Orthodox Jew who saves over 300 girls from Auschwitz. And it's a true story. And we filmed in Tel Aviv, and we filmed in Slovakia.
Wow.
Where the town, the actual town where this took place. And it's an independent, doesn't have the budget of a Schindler's List, but it has the emotional impact of it.
Hmm. Wow. That's really cool. And now, Robert, if folks want to find out about the upcoming concert, the upcoming show, other shows that are on the near horizon as well, and the music, everything else, where's the best place for everybody to keep up with all that, Robert?
Well, right now I got a website that kind of works. We're getting it revamped. It's called DavySingSinatra.com, and they could find information there. But you could find it on Facebook, Robert Davi, at Robert John Davi, or at Robert Davi on Instagram. I always post a show there and other comments at Robert Davi on Instagram. And that's kind of where the music is and stuff. On X or Twitter, I get very political sometimes. So that's another story. That's at Robert John Davi, but enter at your own risk.
That something about that just tends to bring that out of people, doesn't it?
It does.
Now, Robert, there was another question, another thing I wanted to ask you about before we finish up. I know that this coming up during the holiday season as well, and after the last couple of ugly years that we've dealt with, Robert, how much do you look forward to maybe getting back to some of those Christmas and holiday traditions that maybe bring back a little bit of nostalgia for us, and maybe make us forget our differences so much and remember how much alike we are?
I think it's very important to have that. You know, I love the holidays. I love that you can go into the store now and it's starting to, the stores are starting to have, at least in Florida. Now, L.A., it used to be different. I left L.A. after 46 years. I moved to the Tampa area. And you can go into the store and you can start to see Christmas decorations. Mm-hmm. And it's even a Cracker Barrel is loaded with Christmas decorations and music. And I think it gives us a nice reprieve and has us deal with our humanity and our common, you know, our commonality in terms of living in a world that's finite, but has this season of joy that we should celebrate and unify with.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, Robert, it has been a privilege over the years. I appreciate you giving me some time over the years. It's nice to catch you face to face this time. And again, My Kind of Town, Robert Davi, ticket reservations. You can find more info, bokablackbox.com. And of course, on all the socials. And Robert, it has truly been a privilege to visit with you today, sir.
And with you, Cameron, thank you and God bless you and Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and whatever else. Happy Thanksgiving coming up.
There you go. It's just around the bend as well.
Yes, it is.
Zombies, asteroids, another Y2K. In general, how do you think that you'd fare in an apocalypse? A new poll found a third of us think that we would be among the last ones standing. So some of us are being a little overconfident there. Now, the top reasons people think that they'd do well are their solid survival skills and their ability to adapt to any situation. You know, like a zombie gnawing on your foot. Now, the survey was commissioned by a sandwich chain. So they asked people which foods they'd miss most. Now, sadly for their marketing team, pizza is number one, not sandwiches. Now, this might be our favorite stat, though. People were asked to name the top teammates that they'd want on their apocalypse survival team, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson got more votes than Superman. The top five are The Rock, Chuck Norris, Superman, John Cena, and MacGyver. Not a single woman made the top 10, which is, well, some BS, but somehow, Elon Musk is ninth. So like we said, a third of us think that we could survive the end of the world, which means the remaining two-thirds of us completely relate to anything on today's list of the top signs you would not survive the apocalypse. First off, you can't break a nail without announcing it. You couldn't consider DoorDash an essential worker. You wear UGG boots anytime it dips below 60 degrees. You faint at the mention of blood. Your therapist filled a notebook about you, and you only met once. You say, ew, more times than a vegan watching a hot dog eating contest. Howie Mandel tells you to ease up on the Purell. The closest you've been to nature is Rainforest Cafe. And the final sign that you wouldn't survive the apocalypse, the last time you saw a spider, you hit a note that made Mariah Carey jealous. Well, once again, we do thank you for joining us for this 8th episode in Season 4 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, question, anything else you'd like to know, you can hit us up on the socials, Instagram, X, TikTok, Facebook. Just find us at Cameron Dole. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel, The Cameron Dole. If you have a special guest idea, just email me, gqwithcam@gmail.com. We do appreciate our good friend Brandon Allen for coming up with our theme music. We're going to let him play us out and hope you guys have a great rest of your week.